Keep a smile on my face, even when it's looking very grim. I think about them babies innocent like cherubim. I'm living in the Everwind. There is more black people owning things than there's ever been.
Welcome back. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines. In our next segment, we're going to talk to Bill Goodman from the Center for Constitutional Rights. For over 4 years, the National Security Agency, with approval from the President, has engaged in a program of widespread warrantless electronic surveillance of communication in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. On January 17, 2006, this year, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit against President Bush and the head of the NSA, challenging that the surveillance of persons within the U.S. without judicial approval or statutory authority. So the suit argues that the NSA surveillance program violates a clear criminal law and exceeds the President's authority under Article 2 of the Constitution and violates the First and Fourth Amendment. We'd like to welcome Bill Goodman to the show. Bill is the legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights based in New York City and lead attorney in the lawsuit against CCR versus Bush. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Bill, why don't you help? You know, I have to admit, you know, today I was a little overwhelmed trying to understand. I get it that, you know, the government, after post 9/11, you know, increased its surveillance upon, you know, most of its citizenry, particularly folks of Arab descent. But help us understand what this controversy around spying and what has been discovered about the NSA program and what's new. In other words, because given that the government has always ran, you know, hard facts against dissidents, has always surveyed groups in the past, what's so different now?
Well, I suppose what's different here, we don't know much about this program. My sense is that this program was vast, that there were hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of calls that were intercepted, and where there was, where the right of privacy was breached. So one aspect of it, I suppose, is the massive quantity. But the more important factor is the factor that the government is, unlike in the past, ready, willing, able, and proud to admit that it has been violating the privacy rights of so many Americans. Mm-hmm. And they say they do it in the support of the war on terror, and therefore they have dispensed with the requirement that a court be involved. This is government lawlessness, and we've seen some examples of government lawlessness in the past. I mean, there was with the Watergate break-in, for instance, and Nixon's attempt to assert executive privilege again, you know, when they tried to subpoena the tapes of his conversations in the Oval Office, but that failed, and this is also an example, similar example of government lawlessness, which I hope will fail.
Well, why don't you help us understand your case? I mean, I was reading through it, and I think one of the main questions you're raising is client privilege. In other words, if the government can survey on your conversations, how will anything that you have your discussion with either your client or people related to your client or clients, how will their rights be protected, right? How will there not be incriminating?
Right. Yes, that's an example. That what we're talking about there is the question of what is called standing, or that an injury has occurred. And in this case, we have argued that we are a likely target of this program, that because we fit the profile of people who Bush says he's targeting, we are injured as a result, and therefore we have what's called standing to sue. And so that's what we're saying. We're saying because we're lawyers, we have to, many of us are lawyers in our office, we have to work with clients who are outside the United States. We need to confide in them. They need to confide in us. We cannot do that if we have a reasonable and realistic belief that that these conversations are being tapped.
What's the latest update on the case? And up to this point, I know that the government has not at all responded to the actual lawsuit, right?
They haven't responded. We're expecting a response from them is due within the next several days. Mm. They've delayed it a week at this point. So by the end of this week, we should have an answer. I'm anticipating that what they're going to say is that this was executive privilege. The government can do, the President of the United States can do whatever he wants, given the fact that we are in this endless war against terrorism, and that this is part of his job as Commander-in-Chief to protect the United States, and therefore the court, either the courts nor Congress, can question, challenge, or limit what he does, and that beyond that, the only way that we could ever prove our case is by getting into matters which are privileged by the so-called state secret privilege, in which the government says you can't go there because it's a state secret, and then that's a direct gut check. There's nowhere to go from there. So they're saying we, once they assert state privilege, which they claim they will do, that's the end of the case anyway. All of those are the bases that I expect them to move to dismiss our case on.
How has this battle, I mean, for CCR, given that, you know, you've been at the forefront of a lot of the struggles for civil liberties after 9/11, how have you dealt with, like, how has been the response from people? Because I guess for us, you know, at least here in Los Angeles, you know, my main work is organizing inside communities of color, and in many ways, life is already surveilled in some ways or another. In other words, there's, you know, here in Los Angeles, the debate is having 1,000 more cops so our life could be, you know, more watched and under scrutiny. You know, everyday life for a lot of folks who are particularly poor and of color have always been surveilled. And so I'm attempting to figure out how does, you know, I don't know.
What's the big deal?
Not the big deal, but how is middle America responding to this question? Do they not care? Is it that, you know, security for them is much more important than their own sort of civil liberties? Or have they come into some kind of enlightenment after knowing, hey, my rights are being infringed, but not necessarily, you know, 10 years ago when we talked about, you know, minimum mandatory, you know, for folks who are being caught with drugs or you know, gang injunctions that, you know, limit the ability of people to move in their own barrio, in their own neighborhood. How has that shifted? Let's talk about since September 11th.
Well, far be it for me to speak for middle America, but I'll try. Immediately after this, the extent of this program was revealed, and then followed up by the revelation that the government not only was tapping all of these telephone communications between the United States and outside the country, but also gathering information on completely domestic transactions, communications that we have been having with one another on tens of millions of Americans, that right after those revelations, the polls showed that maybe 60% or a little more of the American population supported that. I predicted, and I was right, that that would drop quickly once people began to realize what a police state this group of criminals, by which I mean the current administration, mm-hmm. has turned this country into, and as this revelation grows, and it can only continue to grow more, it will become less and less popular. So, you know, there will always be people who are frightened, and these kinds of people, by which I mean this government, mm-hmm. governs and controls people with three basic tools. One is fear, one is secrecy, and the last is silence, and they have perfected it. And the use of, you know, here we've got, what have we got? We've got fear, that fear of another terrorist attack. Secrecy, that is, this program is going on until some whistleblower blows a whistle. And silence, which is that they hope that people will not speak up because they are afraid. And so, anyway, that's what I guess the answer to your question.
We're talking to Bill Goodman. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And Bill, I mean, I was reading your own bio, and I see that you've been involved in the civil rights and civil liberty struggles, I mean, for the last 30, 35 years, if I'm catching your age right here.
You are. Actually a little more than that, closer to 40 years.
Wow. So, wow in the good way, not wow in like your old. But I guess I'm trying to, I think what I was trying to say earlier is that, you know, one time there was a movement, you know, there was the Panthers, and there was SDS, and people were, I would at least say, very knowledgeable or would say, you know, given that a lot of people were being assassinated and being killed or being arrested, at least the role of the government was a little bit more clear than now. I mean, in other words, now when they first arrested folks of Middle Eastern descent, a lot of people didn't say much. And in many ways, our movements are also a lot more weaker than at one time. How do you perceive now the struggle? How different is it from 30 or 40 years ago?
The difference now is, and it's true, I mean, people, the civil rights struggle was intense, and there were, major politicians in all of these states and cities who were willing and ready and able to strike a deal with the Ku Klux Klan and, you know, elements of racism and forces of racism. But it was all secret. Nobody was willing to say, yes, this is what democracy has turned into. We now proudly admit that we detain people without any rights under the Fourth Amendment any longer. People will be detained indefinitely. We now proudly admit that we use torture from time to time, and this is something we have to do. We now proudly admit that we will wiretap your telephone calls. All of these things are now out in the open, and what it is, it's a bid to try to get people to say, yes, you know, that sounds good. We need this kind of leadership. We need a strong man. We've got at least one strong man in Dick Cheney and maybe another one in the President of the United States. And, this is a replay of Mussolini 80 years later or something like that. That's what we're talking about.
Well, why don't you help us understand who Michael Hayden is and to me, even the National Security Agency, because outside of, you know, being hooked on a lot of these, you know, shows that make you want to, you know, believe that law enforcement is really good for you, that I really like. I mean, I like the shows that teach you about how they're thinking about surveilling us or, you know, catching a criminal.
Yeah, that's how they crack the crime.
How they crack the crime. Help us understand who Michael Hayden and what has been the debate. Because at least I heard some of the hearings early on last week, and at least a lot of folks were raising the debate around his own inaction or his own seeming willingness to move forward with the NSA spying on folks here in the United States.
Yeah, Hayden has more than just been inactive. He has been a proactive element in engaging in the NSA wiretapping project, and not just the NSA wiretapping project. It is his agency under his guidance, under his leadership, that has directed this policy of keeping track of who you call, who calls you, on a purely domestic basis. Now, this is not the Los Angeles Police Department we're talking about. It's not the New York Police Department. This is it's not the FBI. This is the military. This is the National Security Agency, which is the intelligence agency for the Army, Air Force, and Navy. And these guys, this is a total intrusion of the military establishment into the everyday lives of everyday Americans. It is one of the most cherished traditions of American democracy that we have a civilian-based, civilian-led, civilian-operated government, and that we will not be militarized, because once we are, what do we become? We become a country which is, you know, militarized. We are living under martial law and in a police state. That's what Hayden was responsible for, and that's what he did. The wiretaps that he conducted were clearly illegal. Indeed, as you pointed out, were criminal under the FISA statute. They also violated the Fourth Amendment. The collection of evidence of this kind of material by this kind of military agency, I think, violates the cardinal principle of American democracy, which is that the military will be led by the civilian sector of the country and not vice versa.
Well said. Bill, why don't you help me understand also right now, how do you, let's say we're now, 5 years after 9/11, and I know you've had CCR has had some major victories or some very important victories against the U.S. government, and particularly the cases around Guantanamo and a lot of the folks who have been detained. What's your landscape at this moment? I mean, in many ways, the Democrats are at least now raising some debates, and in the beginning, they really raised a lot of debates against, you know, the incursion of the police state on people's lives. Have you seen an important shift? Do you still see that that the question around national security is still a major issue that people still want to run on and win votes over? Or has there been some form of national consciousness on this question?
Well, it's hard to say, you know. I mean, we now, this is a presidency which is in, as far as if you take public opinion polls seriously, and I think he does anyway, this is a presidency that's in deep trouble. He's at, I think the figure I keep hearing quoted is 29%. The vice president, who seems to be a major force in all of this, is, I think, lower than 20%. He has the lowest popularity rating of any vice president in history, including Aaron Burr, who killed Alexander Hamilton. So, you know, this is a deeply unpopular government. And I think its unpopularity is due to a number of things. The war in Iraq has to be part of it. But part of it is the sense that Americans understand and appreciate that these cherished rights, you know, if it may be a flawed democracy, but these are democratic rights. The right to free protest and free speech. The right to be free from unreasonable arrests and from unreasonable searches and seizures. The right to be able to conduct a telephone call and know that Uncle, you know, that Big Brother isn't listening in. All of these are definitely up for grabs at this moment, and if we let them grab it, they're going to grab it away from us.
So, Bill, I know you're going to be out here in L.A. At the Southern California Library on June the 3rd. Do you know, I mean, I'm trying to remember, looking at the flyer, what the topic of your conversation is going to be out here.
I think we'll be talking about many of these things, and we'll be talking about the lawlessness that is called Guantanamo and torture in the United States. You know, all of these lovely if you want to have a few laughs, don't come, I guess, to listen to my little talk. But I hope that we'll have a lively and enlightening conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, the conversation around this is not that it's, I mean, one, it's hard for me. I would say, you know, given that I relatively have, you know, the so-called freedom to say whatever I want to say on the show, except cuss, I think. Megan LaPeak always looks at me and if I'm about to cuss, and, you know, I know that I'm a very public figure, and I worry that I know I'm pretty loose about whatever security measures I should take on. But in many ways, I guess I really worry sometimes that we try to talk about the question around freedom in the United States as a given right, given that, you know, it's a generally very liberal constitution, yet historically it's never necessarily been that, you know, it's never been at the guise of certain folks. It's not always been democratic for black people in this country. It's never been democratic for Latinos and broader, or, you know, if you have a dissident voice, if you're from the left, I mean, the Palmer Raids and all these things. To me, I guess it's like, it's amazing how when it sort of hits home in some ways, or when it hits sort of middle America, when they're finding out that their Yahoo account is being tapped, that the question is being actually raised to a debate. And instead of like the everyday life on how people are already being surveyed and overlooked by some overseer, Big Brother.
Well, there are two ways of looking at the point that you just made. One is that that's fully true. We live in a country which is in many ways built off the backs of African slaves and continues to be, and in which racism is not simply a thing of the past that created slavery. It's a living and breathing part of how this country is run. That's one thing. On the other hand, I think that as this nation gets closer and closer to the paradigm that we see in the third world, which is that there are a handful of very, very wealthy people and a mass of very poor people, and as this nation inches in that direction, and people's health care starts evaporating, and people's pensions start evaporating, and people's right to jobs start evaporating, and people's right to be free from race discrimination starts to be weakened, and people's right to be free from police misconduct and police brutality starts to weaken, you know, and all of these things, as this happens, and as jobs go away, and as the right to any kind of health care system turns to dust, then everybody understands the ways in which African Americans have been treated for 300 or 400 years, and the ways in which Latinos have been treated. All of these things now are put sharply into focus, and the sad part is that people are treated like dirt, even though they've, you know, given their lives, generations have given their lives to create this industrial system that we live in. And that's terribly sad, but at the same time, it presents some opportunities for us to build, to work across race lines, mm-hmm. in some cases, what were class lines, build a real movement to turn this country around.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thank CCR also for some incredible work. I know that I appreciate y'all, at least keeping some of my rights out there in the world to be true.
We'll keep fighting for you.
So on Saturday, January the 3rd, y'all can catch Bill Goodman at the
June 3rd,
at the Southern California Library. You can go to SoCalLib.org. Is there any way they can get a hold of you, Bill? CCR's webpage.
Our website is at www.ccr-ny.org.
Well, thank you, Bill Goodman. So folks, stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break, and we'll have our final guest, Ron Goches from Unión del Barrio.